Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Francine Foss and Anish Chagpar. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. Dr. Chagpar is associate professor of surgical oncology and director of the Breast Center at Smilow Cancer Hospital at Yale New Haven. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This week, Dr. Chagpar welcomes Dr. Elmer Huerta. Dr. Huerta is director of the Cancer Preventorium at Washington Cancer Institute, MedStar Washington Hospital Center. Here's Anish Chagpar.
So, Elmer, I want to start off by getting a sense of cancer in the Latino population. Tell us a little bit more about what the demographics are, what the risks are, what's the issue?
Well, Latinos in the United States are now the largest minority group. Mm-hmm. There are approximately 51 million people all over the place. Although 65% of all these Latinos are living in the Southwest and are of Mexican descendants. This is very important. But Latinos are in every major city in the United States, and they are all over the place. Latinos, in general, they are young. Demographically speaking, they are, the median age is around 30 years of age, and they have one of the highest birth rates in the country. And so they expect that by the year 2030, they probably will reach the 65 or 70 million people in number in the United States. Latinos in general, they suffer from the same conditions that all mainstream communities suffer. The problem with them is that in general, they lack access to healthcare. And they are the group actually in the United States with the least healthcare insurance rates in this moment. And therefore, they suffer from many conditions that are found when they are late and advanced. Talking about cancer, for example, as you know, there are four cancers that are considered the big ones. Mm-hmm. Lung cancer, colorectal cancer, breast cancer, and prostate cancer. They are the four big ones. When you compare the rates of these four big cancers among Latinos with other populations in the United States, they have less incidence of these cancers. In other words, they are being attacked, quote marks, less by these cancers. But the mortality rates are a little bit higher. So how do you explain that a condition that attacks them less kills them more? It's because they are found late. And that is a problem all over the country because of this lack of access. So in addition to this particularity that having advanced conditions when they are found, they also tend to suffer from what we call the infectious disease cancers. For example, cervical cancer is much more frequent among Latino women. Mm-hmm. Stomach cancer related to Helicobacter pylori. Liver cancer related to hepatitis B and hepatitis C, mm-hmm, are much more common among these groups.
So what is being done to improve access? I mean, when you talk about lower incidence and higher mortality, the first thing I think of as a breast cancer surgeon is lack of access, lack of screening, right? Because, as you say, these people are being found late. So what can be done to improve that access?
Well, number one, it would be great if this year Congress passes the reform of immigration law. That, mm-hmm, would be great because that would mean that 11 million people who have no access now to health care, they will be eligible next year to have this new health plan that is going to be started to be sold at the end of this year. I think that's going to be very positive for this community. So I think in general, the reform of the healthcare system, the Affordable Care Act, is going to benefit enormously the Latino community. But what I have found in my experience in both communities, the Latino community and the African American community in Washington, D.C., is that having an insurance card in your pocket is not enough. Hmm. So access by means of having insurance is not enough. You have to have something else to use your insurance card. You have to have education. You have to have the basic knowledge that cancer can be prevented, the basic knowledge that cancer can be detected early. If you don't have that, you may have your insurance card. You can sit on top of it and then let the condition get out of control, which is something that we have found in Washington, D.C., and this is very disturbing. We found that in my hospital, we have seen hundreds of cases of advanced colorectal cancer in the last years, and 98% of these people, they do have health insurance. So it is not a matter of insurance or access. It's a matter of education too. So when you ask me what can be done, I think what it's in addition to providing them access by means of an insurance card, we need to provide them a lot of education.
And so where does that education start? Is this a fundamental societal issue of better education in the school systems? Is this a public education campaign issue? Where does this start? How does that happen?
I think it's at all levels. It needs to start at home, but in order to start at home, parents need to be educated. And sometimes they come from countries and they are coming from families where prevention, early detection, and health education in general are not big. So we need to use the media, for example. And this is what I'm going to be talking at this conference tomorrow. I made myself that same question 27 years ago. I used to be in medical oncology. I used to give chemotherapy to patients in Peru, my home country. And pretty soon I found out that most of the patients that were sent to me for chemotherapy, they had advanced and incurable conditions. But what it really, really caught my eye was that most of those incurable conditions were cancers that were either preventable or early detectable. It was sad because chemotherapy wouldn't do anything for these patients. Mm-hmm. Talking to these people, I found out that most of these patients, they were very knowledgeable in soap operas, sports, and entertainment. Mm-hmm. But you know what? They didn't know what a pap smear was. They didn't know that cancer can be prevented or detected early. So I said, why is these people so knowledgeable in sports and entertainment? It's because of the media. Mm-hmm. So it was 27 years ago that I asked myself a couple of questions. Number one, would it be possible to use the media to sell health same way that we use to sell it, to sell soap or shoes or cigarettes? And the second question was, would it be possible to have one day a health facility with a sign at the door that would say, this place is only for people without symptoms only? If you want to have a conversation about prevention and early detection and have tests, come in. This is a place for you. And I changed my life. I quit medical oncology. I came to this country. I went to the National Cancer Institute. I got my fellowship in cancer prevention and control. And 20 years ago, I started a clinic in Washington, D.C. But the clinic in Washington, D.C., that's called the Cancer Preventorium, as opposite to the old sanatoriums, remember the old sanatorium, was based in that 6 years ago, six years before the opening of the preventorium, I started to do radio shows for the community. I started to have television shows on a daily basis. So after 6 years of bombarding my community in Washington, D.C. with daily messages on smoking, on pap smears, on mammograms, on eating well, on exercising, check your blood pressure. When I opened my preventorium in 1994, hundreds of people show up. And so far, we have seen almost 32,000 people in the last 19 years. And these people are coming without symptoms because they pay attention to the sign that says this place is for people without symptoms. So I think if we somehow are, innovative in using media, knowing how to reach the communities, it doesn't matter if they are poor, if they have no health insurance, they have no formal education, they will listen to you and they will act upon the information you are giving to them.
That is fantastic. I mean, congratulations on getting people to start looking after their health while they're healthy. I mean, that is the fundamental premise of prevention and screening is to get and be proactive about your health.
Exactly. And consider that these people, my patients, my listeners, they are immigrants. They come from countries where prevention doesn't exist pretty much. And they only listen to the radio. And it is the daily message on the radio that makes them change the attitude and then change the behavior. As I said, this is one side of the coin. People without symptoms who are poor, who are disenfranchised, who have no health insurance, going to look for preventative services. The other side is what I just told you. People who have health insurance, people who live in a nice neighborhood, but because of this lack of education, they let the condition get out of control and they go to the hospital when they are having stage 3 or 4 colorectal cancer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Have you noticed, Dr. Huerta, a decline in late stage cancers due to the preventorium?
It is very difficult to prove that. Even though we have been in the air for 19 years or with the preventorium, we have found very few cases of cancer. Why is that? Because the median age of my patients is 29, because the Latino community in Washington, D.C. is very young.
Mm-hmm.
So I have no time, code marks, to see the effect of this thing until probably the next 20 years, until this cohort of people gets older, because we don't have much older people in Washington, D.C.
Right.
So would be great if I stay 20 more years, and then we can demonstrate that mortality or there has been a shift of the stage. But at this particular moment, it's very difficult because of the age of the community.
Yeah,
they're
but
young.
I would anticipate, you know, as you follow these patients out, that overall, not only would you find a lower rate of cancer, but a lower rate of almost everything else, because, you know, you're trying to prevent chronic disease in total.
Exactly. And that's what I did, because for the first 5 or 8 years, my work was dedicated to cancer prevention and cancer early detection. But then my patients, they asked me, Dr. Huerta, my mother has diabetes. Do you think you can run a blood sugar test on me? Sure. And then I started to broaden my action. And now I do diabetes prevention. I do heart disease prevention and metabolic syndrome prevention.
Mm-hmm.
So I document all these conditions, and I have found over 500 cases of high blood pressure without any signs, without any symptoms. We found dozens of cases of preclinical diabetes. So it is a place, this preventorium is a place now where people go and then get checked, get screened. We found early conditions before they get the symptoms, and then we refer them to proper care.
So let's shift a little bit and talk about prevention. And I want to get to the whole concept of the difference between screening and prevention and how those two are married together. But before we do that, we do have to take a short break for a medical minute. So please stay tuned to learn more information about cancer care in underserved populations with our guest, Elmer Huerta. Right after the break, we're going to talk about what you can do to prevent cancer and improve your health.
This year, over 200,000 Americans will be diagnosed with lung cancer. And in Connecticut alone, there'll be over 2,000 new cases. More than 85% of lung cancer diagnoses are related to smoking, and quitting even after decades of use can significantly reduce your risk of developing lung cancer. Each day, patients with lung cancer are surviving thanks to increased access to advanced therapies and specialized care. New treatment options and surgical techniques are giving lung cancer survivors more hope than they ever had before. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, like the one at Yale, to test innovative new treatments for lung cancer. An option for lung cancer patients in need of surgery is a video-assisted thoracoscopic surgery, also known as a VATS procedure, which is a minimally invasive technique. This has been a Medical Minute, and more information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Anise Chagpar, and I'm joined today by my guest, Dr. Elmer Huerta, and we are having just a vibrant conversation about cancer care in the underserved population. And right before the break, Dr. Huerta, we started to unpack the differences between prevention and early detection, and I want to start to give our audience a sense of what they can do today in order to prevent cancers. Because I think, as you said before the break, one of the things is just education and knowing that cancer can be prevented. So tell us what cancer prevention is.
Great question. Thank you very much. There's a difference between prevention and early detection. Mm-hmm. You know, the epidemiologists call it primary prevention and secondary prevention. What is that? For example, prevention means that you do not get in contact with the cause of cancer. A very classic example is cigarette smoking. If you don't smoke, or you don't let people smoke in front of you, you don't work in a place that is filled of smoke. Luckily, we don't have that anymore in the United States. But if you don't get in direct contact with the smoke, then your chances of getting conditions due to this smoke are going to decrease. That is called primary prevention, which means that because I have avoided to be in contact with the smoke, I'm decreasing my risks of getting the condition. Another example is the UV light, ultraviolet light. If I don't expose to the sun in certain times, etc., I'm going to decrease my risk of getting skin cancer. That is prevention. So prevention means that I do not get in touch with the substance or the factor that causes cancer. Early detection is different, very different. In early detection, the condition, the cancer, already started. But it has this characteristic that is growing so slowly that there is time to find it right on time. And if you find it right on time, you can do an intervention, and then you can cure the condition. Typical example, cervical cancer. You do a pap smear, and if you do the pap smear and you find that the cancer, that the cells are different, they have an abnormality, or they may even have what we call cancer in situ, meaning in the site, then I can cure that. That's early detection. For example, early detection, it works very well for breast cancer too. You do a mammogram, and you find clusters of cells, you know, with calcifications that are the size of little sugar bits. Another example of early detection could be colorectal cancer. If you are 50 or older and you get your fecal occult blood test or you get your colonoscopy, you may find the polyps, which are the disformations that can lead to cancer. So that's early detection. So one thing is prevention. Another thing is early detection. And people should be knowledgeable about these two things, because in our daily lives, we can do this. If you eat well, if you healthy, it means that you eat everything, but you eat small portions, servings, and you prefer vegetables than animal food. If you do exercise every day, then you will get a healthy weight. If you don't smoke, and if you see your doctor before you get a symptom for the checkup, then you will really do prevention and early detection at the same time.
What excellent advice. So in terms of prevention, it's all of the things that not only can prevent cancer, but one would think also make you live just a better life. So maintaining a healthy body weight and exercising not only reduces your risk of a number of cancers, but also your risks of diabetes and heart disease and everything else.
And that is a nice thing, exactly, that what we call risk factors, you know, obesity, overweight, cigarette smoking, sedentary life, all these risk factors are the same for these three big conditions, the three chronic conditions, cancer, heart disease, and diabetes.
Hmm. So some of our listeners may be wondering about alcohol. I mean, on the one hand, we hear that too much alcohol is bad. On the other hand, we hear a glass of red wine once in a while may be good. What's the answer?
Well, the answer is that alcohol is a drug that it has what we call a very narrow therapeutic range. Let me explain this to you. You as a doctor know that this very old medication for heart condition, the digoxin. Digoxin is a wonderful medication, digoxin. This digoxin, I remember when I was in medical school in Peru, we didn't have all these fancy machines that nowadays can measure the exact amount of digoxin in your system. So we used to do trial and error. Mm-hmm. We used to give this medication to patients until they started to vomit and they started to feel very sick. And we say, oh, this is too much. Let's gonna give it in half. Until we found the right dosage of this medication. So if we give too much, they got toxic. If we give them too little, there was no effect of the medication. That's called a narrow therapeutic range. Alcohol is the same thing. Mm-hmm. If you drink alcohol, for a man, 2 drinks a day, that is the maximum amount that your body can tolerate in a quote-marked healthy way. Mm-hmm. If you pass that thing to 3 or 4, which is not much, you are now in the area of toxicity due to alcohol. For women, it's only 1 drink a day. So alcohol is a substance that has this very narrow therapeutic range, in which for men it's only 2 drinks a day and for women it's only 1 a day. Whatever goes beyond those numbers is going to be bad for you.
So let's talk a little bit about early detection. And you mentioned a few key tests that people should be thinking about in terms of early detection. So mammograms for breast cancer, pap smears for cervical cancer, colonoscopies or fecal occult blood for colon cancer. But, you know, recently there's been a lot of controversy and a lot of hoopla in the media about changes in guidelines for these regular screening tests. So give our audience a bit of a sense of what your views are on guidelines, particularly, you know, with regards to PSA for prostate cancer, and even with regards to mammograms for breast cancer. How often should these be happening and for whom? And, I mean, if this is something that we should be doing for our health, how early is too early, how late is too late, and how often is too often?
Well, that's a big, big question, very, very important one to answer. We have to understand nothing in medicine, absolutely, known test is perfect. Everything we do in medicine is imperfect. Mm-hmm. We have to understand that, and we have to start understanding that. Every single test, even a cholesterol measurement, a urine test, an X-ray, a CT scan, a mammogram, a pap smear, a colonoscopy, everything has either false positives, meaning that the test is saying that there is something there, the person gets scared, or false negatives, in which the test says, don't you worry, there is nothing there, when the reality is that there is something there. That's very terrible. Well, so all tests are like that. Mammograms, they have 15% false positives and 10 to 15% false negatives. Colonoscopies, much less than that, but they do have, and PSAs, they do have that. So all tests are imperfect. Said that, these tests have, and there are very few. For cervical cancer, it's pap smear. For breast cancer is the mammogram. For colorectal cancer is the fecal occult blood and the colonoscopy. And for prostate cancer is the PSA and the rectal examination. That's it. Those 4 tests are the only one that have been studied pretty much to demonstrate that they have an effect on early detection. But the rest of cancers, they have no tests. We have no test for pancreatic cancer. We have no test for ovarian cancer. We have no test for stomach cancer or any other kind of cancer. That's why it is important to pay attention to your body, visit a professional at least once a year to talk, to see how you are doing, you know, and finding some signs that something may be wrong so the doctor can intervene early trying to find something. But the reality is that we only have these four tests: pap smears, mammograms, fecal occult colonoscopies, and PSAs. We have no problem with the first three. Pap smears, they have demonstrated all over the place that they do work in detecting early cervical cancer. Same thing with mammograms, and same thing with colonoscopies and fecal occult blood. With PSAs and rectal examinations, we have a big, big problem. Just last week, the American Urological Association, they just released their guidelines, new ones, in which they say that PSA shouldn't be done among men younger than 55, nor men older than 70. And between 55 and 70, the test only should be done after the doctor explains the patient the benefits and the risks of having the test. Why is that? Because study after study, they have shown that the use of PSA and rectal examination in finding early cancer that can be done, cancer can be found, does not decrease the number of men who died of prostate cancer over time. And because treatments are very drastic, either a prostatectomy operation or radiation therapy, men are left with severe side effects for many years to come. That's why all this group of organizations, the American Cancer Society, the National Cancer Institute, the U.S. Preventive Task Force, and now the American Urological Association, they said, you know what, doctor, you have to explain your patient before you do the exam. Mm-hmm. Well, this leads the conversation maybe to the future. Mm-hmm. Because these tests are very gross. That's not the word.
Rudimentary.
Rudimentary. That's the thing. So the future is coming. Last week also we had a great study, and they have shown that, for example, breast cancers and ovarian cancers, they share a lot of commonalities in the study of the genomes of the tumor, the basic structure of the tumor, mutations. So this is very, I would say, philosophically, this is very important to think about. If you think about that, in order to diagnose cancer nowadays, the year 2013, we are using an instrument that was invented 400 years ago, and that in the middle of the 1800s, when Virchow started to study the tumors under the microscope, this is what we kept doing. Nowadays, in Yale, anywhere in the country, in order to diagnose cancer, you need to take a sample, biopsy, and put it under the microscope, and then we classify that cancer according to the organ that came from, and we talk, oh, this is breast cancer, this is pancreatic cancer, this is stomach cancer, skin cancer. So in other words, we define the cancer as the organ where the cancer started. But these new studies are showing us that there is underneath in the genetic composition of these cancers, there are commonalities. And this is important because now we treat organs. And I think the future is that we're going to treat genetic abnormalities. So it is very exciting what's coming in the next years.
Dr. Elmer Huerta is director of the Cancer Preventorium at Washington Cancer Institute, MedStar Washington Hospital Center. If you have questions or would like to add your comments, visit yalecancercenter.org, where you can also get the podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.